Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, decades of agriculture in the Driftless area led to the deterioration of many trout streams. And there are people, though, that are working to help the environment and the fish in that area. And we'll be talking about the Driftless area restoration efforts with our guest, Peter Jonas. Peter is the Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited. And in addition to hearing about stream restoration, Peter will also share how you might get involved with fly fishing and with trout fishing. So I hope you'll join in. What do you know about fly fishing, for example? Tell us about the stream restoration efforts in your area. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Peter Jonas, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Larry. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about Trout Unlimited to begin. Tell us about the work of Trout Unlimited.
Trout Unlimited is a fabulous organization. We like to think of it as a conservation organization with a fishing problem. So we have 6,000 members across the state, and in addition to our work in the Driftless, we have a Great Lakes team that is doing fabulous works on the Great Lakes tributaries. We have active chapters in the Central Sands area and all over the state doing marvelous conservation work.
Let's zero in a little on the Driftless area restoration effort. What is really the goal there?
The Driftless area restoration effort, we really have three overarching projects that we work on. The largest and the central one is really our stream restoration efforts. So in the 20 years since the Driftless Area Restoration Effort, or we call it TUDARE, has existed, we have restored over 350 miles of trout streams. So that's 17 and a half miles a year. And then following that, we've begun doing work on fish and aquatic organism passage. So we have crews going around the Driftless that are looking at culverts, bridges, other impairments to streams, evaluating them for both fish passage concerns and for flood resiliency. And we're sharing this information with municipalities and want to partner with them to eliminate fish passage obstacles. And then the third thing is we're creating a conservation portfolio of the Midwest, and that's really designed to get as much knowledge as possible about where brook trout are at, because they are our native species and they are the most vulnerable. So we want to have all of the scientific data possible to provide the best habitat solutions and the best policy solutions to see them continue on.
That's a lot there, and I think you indicated partnerships, and I probably do some work. I was thinking of my daughter who had an internship last summer where she was doing water quality and
is that right?
And doing some did a little fish shocking in streams too as part of a DNR research project, and I imagine you folks work with them as well.
We do. You know the old saying, it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a lot of partners to restore a trout stream. We work with the Department of Natural Resources, but our two main funding partners are actually the Fish and Wildlife Service through the Department of Interior and the National Fish Habitat Partnership Program, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And we work through them through the Regional Conservation Partners Program. And between those two federal programs, $1 million is spent every year on stream restoration in the four states of the Driftless region. And a lot of that money then has to be matched, or it has to be supplemented with additional resources. And that's where our TU local chapters come in. A lot of state programs can be used for these match through our county conservation projects. We also partner with organizations like Pheasants Forever, for example, in terms of planting native species and riparian corridors, and many other conservation organizations. Friends of Wisconsin Wetlands were it's so important to find ecosystem solutions to conservation problems.
Hmm. Richard in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there.
All right.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Good.
On break, so I'll make it quick. I'm going fishing in a couple weeks for the opener down in Minnesota, but I actually fish the northeast corner of Iowa, and I got secret streams that have brookies in them, big ones. But I got brook right in front of my house here in Two Rivers. I live across the Shoto Dam, and they plant some, but you also get some to come up from the lake, and that's right at the Shoto Dam there.
Yeah,
it is. I think the Lake Michigan tributary fisheries, while that isn't my professional area of interest, it's certainly an area of interest of mine as a angler, and we have some spectacular opportunities. I was fishing in downtown Milwaukee the week after Christmas for those sea florellan brown trout, and they are massive brown trout. And I thought I'd be the only lunatic out there. And it was jumping. I mean, there were so many people out there fishing with all different methods. I thought, this is fantastic in the center of our largest urban area to have a fishery like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Richard, thanks a lot for calling Ross in Crawford County. What's on your mind? Ross, need to get...
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Ross.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've got property in eastern Crawford County. I've got it's a stream, Knapp Creek, and it feeds into the Wisconsin River down by Wazeek, I believe. And the question I have is, I think the stream was probably straightened, I'm just going to say 100 years ago, or whenever the initial farmers came in, and then as time marched on, they realized that the agriculture in some of those valleys just wasn't any good. It's too wet. And so we have a stream that has brook and brown trout, and but when we have these heavy rains, it turned into just a big channel, and I'm wondering about remeandering the stream. That is, I probably have like about 10 acres in length, so I'm not sure if it, you know, but so it's straightened probably on both sides, but I'm just wondering if it's worth to remeandering to kind of mitigate some of those floodwaters. Instead of rushing down the stream, they might be able to spread across the land a little bit. How I would go about that.
Yeah.
You are exactly the type of landowner we want to talk to. I will say that. And the short answer is yes, remeandering is possible. It can be an expensive project, but I would not let that scare you off, because it is also a project that many, many partners are interested in supporting for a whole variety of reasons. We do have a lot of straightened streams in the Driftless region, and remeandering just provides many, many environmental benefits. So I would encourage you, I'm wondering, it's Ross, right, speaking
Ross.
With?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if we can get his contact information, the producers offline perhaps, and I would love to have a further conversation with you about that, because you can do a real environmental solid for the land that you're a steward of.
So, Ross, hang on there, and I think Clara will be able to grab, I think she's going to be able to grab your information so that Peter can get a hold of you after after the show's over at some point.
You bet. I would like to do that.
Appreciate your call very, very much. So the whole business of restoration in the first place, it's amazing. Well, if you look at a lot of the streams, like the Kickapoo area, for example, those are meandering. They look like kind of like snakes going through the water, and but they serve a real purpose.
Oh, yes. I mean, when streams are straightened and you lose a natural riparian corridor, you create all kinds of problems downstream, although we've been able to work with them. And in some instances, depending on what funding is available, we can do solutions that aren't a complete meander. But when we can get an opportunity to return a stream back to its natural function, that's really what we want to go for. And there is interest in this not only through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, but also we're seeing some of the phosphorus trading credit programs also are interested in remandering projects as well.
Our guest today, Peter Jonas, Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to talk more about trout and trout stream and trout stream restoration. Jim and Camp Douglas, Eugene and Viola, I hope you can hang around. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here talking about trout stream restoration, getting into fly fishing maybe a bit too with our guest Peter Jonas. Peter is the Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited, a great organization. So as we talk with Peter about these Driftless Area and about trout fishing, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the health of our trout streams in that area? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim and Camp Douglas, let's go to you next. Thank you for calling.
Okay, I'm in the Juneau County area and got involved in that stream bank easement project that the DNR funded some years ago. I was wondering, how did that do? And then one other question. I see they do have a catch and release program for fishing trout. My experience is they're pretty sensitive fish, and any handling can pretty much end their life. And I was just wondering why they would do that or if they are still doing it. So I'll hang up and take your answers offline. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Right. Thanks, Jim. So conservation-minded and public-spirited landowners are fundamental to the work that we do in the Driftless, because virtually all of the conservation work we do is on private land. And so to give the public access to that land, we rely most often on easements. Once in a while, a land acquisition, but by and large, an easement. And so first of all, thank you for being willing to provide an easement. And this project is continuing. Both the DNR does easements, but we also have many counties that provide landowners the opportunity to offer a public easement. And in the Northern Driftless, where I live, many easements, in fact, are held by rod and gun clubs. So there are a variety of public entities that administer easements, but they're really essential to our work. Your second question related to catch and release.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, it is true that trout need to be carefully handled, and that there is mortality if a fish is hooked very deeply. But there have been on all kinds of research to show that the survival rate is actually quite high for fish that are caught on artificial lures or flies, and by anglers who keep their hands wet, keep the fish in the water most of the time, maybe lift them up for a very quick picture, and let them go. So catch and release has actually been quite successful. But I will say this also about catch and release. We've sometimes maybe, in my personal opinion, made more of a doctrine of it than is really necessary, because the reality of our driftless streams is that a lot of our driftless streams could really use a bit more harvest, frankly. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with harvesting a trout in in most streams that's legal. It's not legal this time of year, by the way. Folks to know that. So you don't go out and do it today. Wait for the first Saturday in May. But where it is legal, many of our driftless streams can support harvest, and particularly of brown trout. They often are out competing brook trout, and doesn't hurt anything to have a few for the skillet.
Thanks again for that question. Duke and Viroqua, will go to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Duke.
Peter.
Duke is a good friend, I got to say, Larry, and he is part of the founding story of TU Dare. So we are being blessed by a giant right now.
Thanks, Peter.
What's on your mind, Duke?
Well, Peter, could you talk briefly about how these thousands of miles of driftless streams got into the degraded condition that they've been in for decades? Before this restoration work got underway. And can you talk a bit about, for people that aren't anglers, what about how does watershed restoration benefit landowners and other recreationists and communities?
Mm-hmm. All right, Duke, thank you.
I'll make up that. Thanks for the show.
You bet. And this really gets at the heart of what we're about. So when we look at the driftless area historically, once European settlement started to happen in the driftless in the 1800s, and they brought the agricultural methods that they knew at the time, those methods were very hard on our steep, hilly landscape and on our Midwestern climate. So that combination led to just enormous amounts of soil coming down from our hillsides into river valleys. So if you go to a typical driftless stream that hasn't been restored, and here you all often find when someone's explaining this, we have to talk with our hands a lot, which doesn't really do any good on radio. But when you go into a stream that isn't restored and you look at it kind of like a cross section, it really sort of looks like a U. In other words, the banks are very steep going down to the stream bed, and the banks in extreme conditions are often unvegetated. They're so steep. And those banks are eroding large quantities of topsoil, and they're also, when they erode, large quantities of phosphorus are going into the water stream. So what we try to do when we restore a stream, the first thing we want to do is it's called giving that stream its floodplain back, or reattaching it to its floodplain. So instead of a U, think of a cross-section of maybe a very shallow custard dish would be, I guess, how I would explain it. And that gives the stream riparian corridor back its ability to support also all kinds of non-game species. In addition, it's not just about trout. And also we can plant prairie grass in that corridor. So we want to work on the shape. By doing that, We, over the lifetime of TU Dare, we keep 17,600 pounds of phosphorus contained per year. That's okay. Phosphorus not going into our water stream. And we contain 50,000 tons of sediment per year. That's sediment that is not going down to the Mississippi Delta. And, you know, I love Wisconsin. I want to keep it here. Louisiana has got more.
They don't need it.
Yeah. They don't want it. They got more than they can use. We want to keep it here. And then finally, by returning that stream to the flood plain, we are really helping that stream to function correctly when floods and high water events come, that instead of that water going down like a fire hose, it is dissipating out during a high water event, and then it is allowing that water to soak in the soil and do its job. So I would say, even if you're not an angler, the work that we're doing is really vital to our society and being able to live in harmony with our environment.
And I did have a caller, you know, and I should have asked or should have mentioned this. A caller wonders, where the heck is, what is the driftless area and, you know, where is it contained and so forth? And I should have just done that right off the bat. So,
well, the driftless area is a four-state area. And it is really named, it's unique in that it's named for something we don't have, which is mainly glacial drift. So we don't have the material that is left behind, like the moraines and other parts of Wisconsin by the receding glaciers. And what we do have are our marvelous limestone aquifers. And so the streams that run through the driftless are spring creeks. They're refreshed by groundwater. And it's characterized by a very hilly topography and by streams that run at a fairly cold, constant temperature throughout the year. And this area encompasses southwest and west central Wisconsin. It also has some of southeast Minnesota, northeast Iowa, and even just a sliver of northwest Illinois also falls in the driftless topography. And our TU Dare effort does work in all of these states to improve trout streams and watersheds.
We have Eugene and Viola with a comment, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Larry. You kind of mentioned it earlier, but the Kickapoo here, you've got about a half a dozen trout streams that empty into that, and they stock all these trout streams up in here, and you'll have license plates from all over up in here when the trout season opens.
Yeah, absolutely, and actually there's a big financial boon to the communities from trout fishing.
Absolutely. We've done economic studies. We're due for another one. And millions of dollars in financial activity are generated by trout fishing throughout the driftless every year. And Eugene is really in the heart of it when you think of the Viroqua area. That is the area that has benefited the most. I will say this about Eugene's comment, though. I think he'd be surprised to know that most of those trout that he's talking about in that area of Wisconsin are actually wild trout. There is still some stocking that goes on, but by and large, those streams have been improved to the point where they have robust natural reproduction. And in Trout Unlimited, you know, all trout are beloved children of God, but we do favor some more than others. And we favor wild native trout, number one, and then wild non-native trout, and then stock trout. So we do have a bit of a hierarchy in terms of the trout we prefer.
And the wild natives are the best to eat, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Oh, Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Thank you for listening to me today. I'm paying tribute to an excellent trout fisher who died 2 weeks ago. His name is Carl Welke. He trout fished his whole life. He was buried in his waders with his creel and his pole and his fishing hat and $5 in his pocket so he can wet his whistle and get to the other side.
Oh, my.
And Carl started an outdoor club at the Weston School District, and they had the biggest club in the entire Weston school system because he taught them how to hunt and trout fish and fish on the Mississippi. And he was a very honorable man who will be missed by many. A few who are listening probably know Carl Welke, and I bid him adieu.
Suzanne, thank you. And did you know, you knew of Carl?
Yep. But I don't believe that I've ever met Carl, but and Suzanne, thank you so much. That is such a touching recollection. And one thing I have found, and one of the reasons why I really wanted to work for Trout Unlimited, is that when we strive for the healing of our natural world, something that goes on during that is the healing of human relationships and the enrichment of our own experience with each other as human beings and as stewards of the land. And I think of the people who mentored me in my fly fishing journey. One of them was a man named Lowell Gingrich, who lived here in Madison. Just a tremendously generous person in terms of his time, and taught me what it meant to live in a way where I was a contributor to the natural world. And, you know, as you spoke so eloquently of Carl, that is what we try to be about.
Yeah. Absolutely. I saw a piece on Trout Unlimited, a story on Trout Unlimited that you wrote that had me pause to think for a bit. The title of it was, "Are My Secret Streams Really My Secret to Keep?" And I flash back to when I first started. I was interested. I was doing other fishing, but I hadn't done any trout fishing. And I had a friend who said, "Oh, okay, I'm going to tell you where to go, and you will catch trout." And he told me a spot, and I went there, and then I never felt like I could tell anyone else about it, because it felt like it wouldn't have been right for me to do that. But now a lot of years went by, and then there was a young person who wanted to start trout fishing. So that's the only person I ever told, because I thought, well, you can still catch a lot of fish there. and that kind of comes through out in your piece.
Yeah, and I think so much of this is contextual. This article did what I hoped it would do. It really sparked a lot of conversation on our TU online message board and amongst friends and colleagues of mine, and that was my intention. And a lot of it is contextual. So, you know, there are times when a person just kind of shares a piece of information with you, and a condition of the sharing of that is for you to keep it secret. And then I think, you know, you're kind of obliged, although I think there is a statute of limitations, like you experienced with your young person. But I also think we sometimes miss some opportunities. We get so caught up in saving a spot for ourselves, we miss some opportunities to really introduce someone to the joy of angling in a really special place. And being an angler is not the only way to care about cold water resources or to become a conservationist. You know, people develop a passion for conservation issues through a whole variety of avenues, if you will. But it is one very effective way to help a person start to see their connection and their impact on the natural world. And frankly, it's something I'm concerned about because our numbers of anglers each year are on a decline in the state of mm-hmm. Wisconsin, and it seems to be a bit harder to draw people into the outdoor sports, and I think we need mm-hmm. to be intentional about that.
And, you know, for maybe spend a minute or two, it doesn't take a lot to get involved in fly fishing. Let's talk about that for a minute. For
right.
somebody who's not done it before.
Right. You know, the main reason I always fished as a child, but the main reason I got into stream trout fishing was it was financially accessible. I started fishing with a spinning rod, a piece of split shot, a hook, and a worm. And,
yeah.
you know, pretty much you can get yourself going for around $30, you know, and then comes waders and other accoutrements, you might say. But it's a very accessible way to start fishing. And I would say even for fly angling, you know, other anglers sometimes give us the razz about all of our fancy equipment and so forth. But when you compare that to the cost of a bass boat, I'd say you can be decked out in Orvis and you can still be spending a heck of a lot less money on angling. So, you know, it's a very accessible way to fish, to fish on foot on a trout stream. And there are all kinds of opportunities to get started. You know, your local fly shop is a great resource to look at that. They often sell beginner outfits that are designed for the driftless. So you get the fly rod, the reel, the line, the leader, they'll help you set it up and so forth. A lot of Trout Unlimited chapters and clubs have fishing events where you can learn. And, for example, I'm doing an event at the Whitehall Public Library where I'm going to be teaching people how to cast a fly rod and a little bit about how to fish. So we're, all of us who are engaged in the sport really realize that we need to be intentional about inviting others to participate in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about how I learned to throw a fly rod. My friend took me out in the boat in the lake.
Nothing wrong. A lot easier to lot fewer stuff around for your back cast to get tied up in. So that's not the worst idea. Yeah.
Well,
I'm actually a big believer of the lawn is yeah. the place to start rather than the stream. And try to hit a hat, and then we'll take you out to the stream and see what you can do.
And the trout, what's the address for the online address for Trout Unlimited?
TU.org. Very simple. Very simple.
TU.org. That's the place to go if you want to learn a little more about the restoration projects that are going on, but also to learn about maybe some of those classes or maybe other ways you can get involved with trout fishing and fly fishing. Peter Jonas, I hope you'll come back and be with us again. He's Driftless Area Partnership Specialist for Trout Unlimited. And thank you so much for listening in today. Tomorrow we'll talk with an author about losing a spouse, and we'll also talk with a psychologist about that same topic. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.